Few more. Okay, so rather than start talking about papal infallibility, what we're going to focus on this month is the whole idea of papal primacy. So that is very much our topic for tonight and also for the next couple of Tuesdays, the primacy of the Pope. So what we are going to be looking at is the particular authority that the Pope has. So let's reflect on this word authority. If you had to give a definition for it, what would you say is authority? Authority. How do we use that? Would you like to do an impromptu definition of authority?
You're given some kind of
Okay. Yeah. Responsibility definitely is part of that notion. There's a responsibility. What's that?
In charge.
In charge. Whoever has authority is in charge. Okay. So definitely key ideas. What else could we use as a loose definition for authority?
The right to rule, maybe?
The right to rule. Yeah. Who has the right to exert a power over somebody else?
But who gives you that right, too?
Where does that authority come from? Where does that power come from? Excellent notions to keep in mind as we look at authority. Anything else, Peter? You had something else?
I was going to say that the right to rule and govern.
The right to rule and govern. And it's not in your study sheet here, but I'm reminded of, I think it's from St. Paul's letter to the Romans. He says, all authority is from
God.
Or I think in some translation may even say from above.
Yeah.
So we think about that. Anybody who tells somebody else to do something, exerts a power over that person, that has to come from God. What was the first authority that we were subject to in our lives?
Parental
authority. Okay, and so God established the authority of parents over their children by the very fact that He allows them to procreate their bodies. He creates the soul. By that very fact, parents have the right, a power over their children. What other authority is established by God?
Government.
Government is authority or the right to power of somebody in civil matters, and that comes from God. So when we have an election for a president, a senator, a governor, a mayor, we are not giving that authority. We are saying to God, here's the candidate we elected, and then God gives the right to that person to rule. What other authority? Yes.
I have a question.
Yes.
When rights are things that are given to people or bestowed upon people by reason of birth.
Yeah. So in other words, God-given rights is what you're trying to say, what you...
Yes,
meaning to say.
Life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness.
Okay.
Okay, but this sort of thing, this authority is not a right as far as what I'm understanding. It's a delegation. Delegation by God to this particular candidate.
Right. Okay, so if I can just, I'll just expand on what you were saying. These are our God-given rights. Life, liberty, property, and marriage. I know the Declaration of Independence is life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, but we're going to... These are God-given rights that are inherent in the human condition.
Right.
And actually, these can be given, these can be alienated or given away. As a matter of fact, religious do by the vows they take. They give up liberty, property, marriage, but you cannot give up life on your own authority. Okay? But I agree with what you were saying there, that authority is not inherent in a human person. Otherwise, we'd all be bossing each other around.
Right.
Okay, so yes, that's why, so you see, the authority is not one of the God-given rights that everybody has. Okay, that has to come from God. So God has established parental authority, he's established civil authority, and then God also established religious authority or authority in his church. Okay, and we know that, I mean, how much authority did our Lord give to his apostles? Well, to St. Peter, he gave the keys of the kingdom. To the other apostles, he says, he who hears you hears me. So he says, I'm sending you to rule with my authority. Yes.
So how does that work with people that aren't exactly following God's laws, that are in positions of... authority.
Well, okay, what happens is sometimes you have bad rulers.
Yeah.
You know, but that's not why we obey a ruler or not. We don't say, I obey this authority. You see, a child can't be saying, I'll obey my parents only if they're doing what they're supposed to be doing. It doesn't work that way. You know, the parents aren't always going to be, well, the parents aren't perfect. So it's the principle. As long as a civil ruler is exercising lawful authority, whether even if he or she is not a good person, you still, out of respect for the office, you respect the authority they have. You know, even the early Christians had great respect for the emperor. The only time they wouldn't follow the emperor is when they told them to go worship idols or commit a sin, because God has to come ahead of any civil ruler or ahead of anybody. Okay, so this is what we're looking at with authority. And okay, now here's the point I want to make, and we really have to understand this. This authority of the Pope is the very authority of Jesus Christ. Let that sink in. In other words, the Pope doesn't have this because of himself personally. When he's elected, he has the authority, he has the right to teach the whole church. He has the right and the duty to rule the whole church. He has the duty to sanctify the church. So it's not like there's papal authority over here and Christ's authority. What is it? It's the same thing. Christ gives that, he shares that power with the Pope, whoever he may be. And that's why we have the utmost respect for a true pope. That's why we give him the greatest respect to anybody on earth. Right? Because who has a higher power than that? Who has a greater authority than that? And there is nobody.
You said it a few minutes ago, I think. When the Pope speaks on matters of faith, it's as if Jesus was speaking.
That's right.
Correct.
That's right. That's an excellent way to put it. And that's what Pope Pius XII said. He said, don't think it's two different authorities. It's the authority that Christ has, and he says, here, Pope so-and-so, I place it in your hands. I want you to use it in my name here on earth. Isn't that awesome? That's just like, wow. Because there is no greater power on earth that anybody could have. Even if a person was the king of the whole world, he wouldn't have the same authority that the Pope has, because a king is still only supreme in temporal matters and the Pope is supreme in spiritual matters. And this also goes to show why the papacy could never be the instrument of the church's destruction. Because then the authority of Christ would be engineering the defeat of the church. Does that make sense?
Yes.
This is why the papacy cannot fail. I'm not talking about individuals. I'm talking about the office. Since the Pope has the authority of Christ, as long as he's using that authority, and he hasn't lost it, he can't be going against Christ in his ruling and teaching. Okay, so let's look at our outline sheet here. Again, it is nothing less than the very authority of Jesus Christ. It is not the Pope's personal power as a human being, but rather the power that has been given to him by Christ himself. He obviously is not given all of Christ's power. For example, our Lord doesn't say, now you get to judge the whole human race at the end of time. Our Lord doesn't give him everything he has, but he certainly gives him a lot of what he has, which is, again, the power to teach, the rule, and to sanctify the church. So, amazing power. You know, what's the kind of respect that's shown for the Pope? I mean, what do we do to show our respect for a true Pope?
Genuflect.
Yes, you genuflect.
Kiss
his ring. You know, even for bishops, we kiss their ring out of respect. And if it's the bishop of the diocese, according to Catholic protocol, you would genuflect on your left knee if you're honoring, if you're greeting the bishop of the diocese. Why? Because he is sharing, not in the same amount of authority as the Pope has, but he's sharing in the authority of Christ. And so we show that respect. It's not just him. It's not about him as a person. It's whose power is he using? Authority. Whose authority does he have? Okay. Yes.
So would we do that if we met the one in Spokane?
No, because he's not a true bishop. Vatican II bishops don't count. They don't have the faith, and they also do not have valid orders. They're actually, you know, like Bishop, so-called Bishop Daly, Thomas Daly. Maybe he's even listening to my talks here on the internet. I'd have to say, with all due respect, you do not have the power of orders, because that was substantially changed way back in 1968. So, they've lost for the most part valid orders. So, that's why we'd not, you know, I wouldn't acknowledge him. Can't, because he doesn't have the orders. He doesn't have the authority.
Well, basically, he's just another man.
He's a layman.
Period.
He's a layman. He doesn't think he is. I mean, the Vatican II priests ordained after the changes, they think they're valid priests, but they're not. The reality is they're not. We studied this topic. You know, what was the problem with the change of ordination? Well, the essential words of consecrating a bishop were completely revamped. And you mess with the essential words of any sacrament, you invalidate the sacrament. So that's the reality. Okay. All right. So, now let's look at the authority that a varying degree. So we see simple priest, pastor, bishop of diocese, and then the Pope. So what kind of authority does a priest have? It's right there in your study sheet. He has the authority to give the sacraments and to preach. That's a spiritual, those are spiritual powers that he has. He has them through his ordination, but he also needs authorization. Okay, now, And I'm not saying this to toot my own horn, because I've been blessed with the vocation to the priesthood, but more than one saint has said if they saw a priest and an angel walking together, they would greet the priest first and then the angel. Why? Because of the power and the authority that God has given to the priest. And that's why every priest is called another Christ, alter Christus. And he, of course, he has to strive in his daily life to live a life of holiness as worthily as he can of the vocation that he's been given. So that's why, I mean, somebody asked me just 2 days ago, Father, why don't we stand up for you every time you, like, for example, you leave the confessional to go into the sacristy to say Mass, but we do stand when Mass begins. And that is, yes, in general, every priest is another Christ, is supposed to strive for the holiness of Christ, but it's when he puts on his vestments that he's acting in the priestly role of Christ, but not when he's going from the confessional or making a visit to the church. So that's, I explained it that way. Yes.
Why don't we stand up at Holy Hour?
Well, people do when he comes out for Benedict, for exposition of the Blessed Sacrament. If he's vested, yeah, we all stand up. Yeah, at the beginning of the Holy Hour, because a priest is vested with at least the stole.
But later on, after, I'm not sure what part you call it, but after you've done in the confessional, you coming back, and then everyone comes back out. We don't stand; we kneel.
No, well, because. During exposition of the Blessed Sacrament, special rubrics take over because our Lord is enthroned on his throne. So that's why the priest is not allowed to wear the beretta when the Blessed Sacrament. Oh, when he comes out. Yes, okay, that's it. Why? Because the Blessed Sacrament is exposed on the altar. So that's the reason.
Blessed Sacrament takes precedence.
Yes.
Over
right, because at benediction, it's just like at the elevation of Mass when the priest is holding up the sacred host and the chalice. Everybody's kneeling in profoundest adoration. So we have it for a whole hour. It's like an hour-long elevation during Mass, or of, you know, the elevation that happens during the Mass. So that's why we have those special rubrics. And we genuflect on two knees versus just one knee. Okay, so that is the respect we give to the priest because of the powers that he has. And a good thing to remember is a priest does an infinite thing whenever he offers Mass. It's infinite. Because there's an infinite distance from something being bread and wine to becoming the divine body and blood of Christ. That's not just a very big leap or a big change. That's an infinite change. So the power of the priesthood is something amazing. And I truly believe what St. John Marie Vianney says, that if a priest understood what he could do, he would die of fright. I believe that. You know, because and Saint Alphonsus and others wrote books on the priesthood, and they're scary. I mean, they really get the point across. Do you realize what dignity and what responsibility you have? So it can indeed be scary. Okay, so that's a simple priest, and one thing I didn't put there is I could have probably put simple clerics, like, you know, all the ranks. What are the four minor orders?
Exorcist, acolyte,
doctor. Yes, starting from the bottom up. There's tonsure is at the very lowest when a person becomes a member of the clergy. And as a matter of fact, the church then says if anybody ever laid violent hands on a cleric, they would be automatically excommunicated. Just by the fact that he's been tonsured. Because he's now officially part of the church's clergy. He is now a candidate for higher ordinations. So anyway, there's tonsure, then there's porter, lector, exorcist, acolyte, subdeacon, deacon, and each one gets a higher reverence or respect because more powers are given, more authority is given. For example, only a deacon can distribute Holy Communion, can preach, and also baptize. A subdeacon can't do that. So you see, he gets to share in more and more of the priesthood. All right, so I could have put that there. I didn't think about it. But anyway, let's go on to pastor. Okay, the pastor of a parish, he can do more than what a simple priest can do. He can authorize, for example, in his parish, a priest to officiate at a wedding. Okay, so the pastor gives himself permission. I mean, it's his very duty to officiate at weddings, but one of his assistants cannot have the wedding without his authorization. So it's the bishop shares some of his power with the pastor. So you have the assistant pastor, then you have the pastor. Okay, so a higher amount of power, you might say, a higher authority. Yes.
Is every priest in a rectory, and besides the pastor, of course, but is every other priest in a rectory an assistant pastor?
Usually. In normal times, you know, we're living in extraordinary or abnormal times because we don't have the chain of command as that normally would be there. But in normal times, pretty much every priest is given a designation. When he's ordained, the bishop will give him authorization to administer the sacraments. It'll be detailed on a sheet of paper. Reverend Father, you are now assigned here and you have these powers, and they're pretty clearly delineated.
What I was asking is we have yourself here.
Yes.
We have yourself, Father Brendan, and Father Letourneau.
Yes. Those are appointments made by the bishop.
Okay.
Yeah, so you see an assistant pastor...
Assistant pastors, or just one of them?
No, they're both assistant pastors.
Okay.
Yeah, both are assistant pastors. Now, technically, or according to strict canon law, I don't have the title of pastor, they don't have the title of assistant pastor, because we're doing this without the benefit of the chain of command. You see, Bishop Pibrunis is not the Bishop of Spokane, but he's my religious superior. So we're functioning according to the mind of the church as best we can in our extraordinary circumstances.
Bishop Pibrunis' diocese, basically, the whole United States.
Well, he will never claim that. He knows he can't say, it's my diocese. As a matter of fact, that goes on to the next point. A bishop has authority over a diocese only when a true pope appoints him as the bishop of that diocese. There's no true pope to do that for Bishop Pibrunis. So he's careful not to arrogate authority to himself that he doesn't have. He says, I do not have ordinary jurisdiction. As a matter of fact, we'll go into that a little bit more, a little bit later on. Again, we have to realize we're not living in normal times. It is, you know, does that mean we do nothing?
No.
Of course not. Does it mean we take on, claim authority that we don't have? No, but we have to function for the salvation of souls. Priests have this most amazing power to give the sacraments, to be spiritual fathers, and even though we don't have that chain of command, it's obvious what to do. Now, I'll give you an analogy that Bishop Musey gave. This is like over 30 years ago, and it works very well. You know, there are people that say, well, wait a minute, you have not been given, you know, specific you know, authorizations by the book according to canon law, you shouldn't be doing what you're doing. And Bishop Musey's analogy was this. Let's say a big fire breaks out somewhere. Let's say it's a building. Do we just stand there and do nothing because we're not licensed firefighters? If we can fight the fire, should we do it? Or do we just say, I don't have the certificate, so let's let everything burn to the ground, let people die in the flames, because I don't have the certification to be a firefighter. Does that make any sense?
No.
Doesn't make any sense. However, if and when the certified firefighters come on the scene, what do we do then? Well, we yield to them. They're doing their job in an official capacity, you know, but we don't just do nothing. It goes against common sense to say, let's do nothing. As a matter of fact, that is the home aloner position. Have you ever heard of this, the home aloner position?
Oh, yes.
Who are the home aloners?
They don't go to church.
They said you can't go anywhere. You know who coined that expression? Father Anthony Chicada. And it was after he saw the movie Home Alone. How many of you saw that? It's about the boy, little boy who gets left home by mistake.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a parody because this wouldn't happen in real life, but supposedly. So he said these whole... So Father Chicada's wit is amazing. He's told me, Father, it gets me in trouble sometimes. But he says, you know, these Catholics that say, we don't have the chain of command, so we have to sit at home and do nothing except pray the rosary. Said it's just nonsense. It's just nonsensical. It's basically saying the church has been defeated, we can do nothing, and that's a heresy. So we have to do what we can, at the same time very respectful of the chain of command, but God hasn't given it to us right now, so we have to do the best we can. We have to save our souls. We have to fulfill our Sunday obligation. We have to make our Easter duty. We have to... These are laws of the church.
Although they like to say it's illicit, and it wasn't Boniface VIII who said necessity makes what is illicit.
Well, exactly. That's the whole point of the home aloners. They'll say, oh yeah, those priests at Mount St. Michael, they're valid priests, but they're illicit. What they fail to understand, could you please look ahead at number 3C? Types of jurisdiction. They act as though there's no such thing as supplied jurisdiction. And it's true, the ordinary jurisdiction is not there, the delegated is not there as far as I can see, but the church doesn't leave us orphans. There's still supplied jurisdiction, which takes care of us in emergency situations. Okay, so varying degrees of authority, we see the respect paid to the priesthood, to those priests that are appointed to be pastors, they have a greater role. And then the bishop of the diocese, he has the fullness of the priesthood. So even though Bishop Pibrunas is not the bishop of Spokane, not the bishop of Omaha, why do we pay him a greater respect than any priest?
Because
it's his authority.
Okay, what is it? What is that authority? What does he have? Is the what?
The fullness of the priesthood.
He has the fullness of the priesthood. He's not limited in any way sacramentally. He can give confirmation in an ordinary manner. He can make other priests. He can even make another bishop. By the way, this November 30th will be the 25th anniversary of him consecrating Bishop Dolan a bishop.
Wow.
Can you believe time has gone, that much time has gone past? Yes.
You could say he's our link back to the apostles, because the priests aren't our link, only bishops are.
Right. Bishops, right. The bishops had the fullness of the priesthood, but there's actually another theological study on how the bishops link to the apostles, and they have to be, have that appointment is necessary as well. And but he, as a bishop, he has the capacity to be appointed the ordinary. You see, it's a capacity that the ordinary priest doesn't have. So this is why we give him greater respect than to any priest, because of the fullness of the priesthood. That's an authority right there. His capacity to be appointed as ordinary by a true pope, and together, I would say, I believe that all the traditional Catholic bishops are carrying on the fourth mark of the church, that apostolicity. Yeah. But that's a whole deep subject in and of itself.
Yeah, it seems like it has to be. I mean, if it's not really explained, because if it isn't, then we've lost apostolicity.
That's right. What happened to the fourth mark of the church? Yeah. So I think that's the only reasonable explanation, that the traditional Catholic bishops, who are definitely bishops and definitely have the faith, somehow they carry on that fourth mark of the church. Yes.
What is the canon for the supply jurisdiction?
It's right at, you'll see it right at the bottom of the page there. Oh, canon 209.
Okay, thank you, Bob.
Okay, very important canon. Okay, so, and then there's the Pope. He is higher than all the bishops. By being Bishop of Rome, he is the successor of St. Peter, and he has the power of Jesus Christ himself. Can I also back up to something about the priest? This story has been told, and I've heard Bishop Pivirunas say it in a sermon at an ordination mass. He said, if in the back of the church right now, he said, Father Smith is in one corner, and Jesus Christ is in the other corner, and both are hearing confessions. If you go to Jesus or you go to the priest, are you equally forgiven?
Yes.
Why? Because Jesus is using his own power, but the priest is using the power that comes from Jesus. It's, you see, it's the same power. So that was making me think, well, it's helping me understand better the power of the Pope. You know, he is the fullness of the episcopacy and all this authority to govern, teach, and rule.
Well, Jesus said, whose sins you shall forgive, they are forgiven.
Yeah. So our Lord made the apostles priests at the Last Supper. But he gave them the official go-ahead to hear confessions three days later on Easter Sunday. He gave them the power on Holy Thursday, but they didn't have the permission to use it quite yet. But he says, it's Easter Sunday night, whose sins you shall forgive, they are forgiven. Whose sins you shall retain, they are retained. Okay. All right. So, types of jurisdiction. And here's a definition I got out of a canon law book. And I was going to give you the reference, and I left only the first open parentheses there. So sorry about that. But anyway, jurisdiction, the public power granted by Christ or by his church through canonical mission of governing the baptized in matters referring to salvation. So ordinary jurisdiction would be the Pope over the whole church, and then each bishop over his diocese. He is the ordinary. And then delegated, this is given by the Pope to whoever he appoints to this or that, and it's also given by the bishops to their own clergy. So in a diocese, a priest can't, after his ordination, just start hearing confessions without getting his faculties from the bishop. He has the power to forgive, but he has to be given permission to use it by the bishop. Okay. And then supplied. This is given by the church for extraordinary situations, and this is the only jurisdiction that I've ever had. I certainly am not an ordinary, and there's been no bishop of a diocese to give me delegated authority, so what do I use? I need this supplied for every Mass I offer, for every confession I hear, for every baptism I give, even preaching sermons. I mean, just functioning as a priest, I have to rely on the church's supplied jurisdiction for that. Otherwise, we'd have to be a home aloneer.
Okay, so because that is a big question now with people like home aloneers and that. Where is the definition, or is there any scriptural, is there anything that you can, we can quote to
well,
re-enhance when you speak to someone what supply means and where it came from?
Well, it's. Actually, let's go to the bottom of the page because that will explain it. Okay, Canon 209. And what that, and as a matter of fact, I think I can tell it to you by heart. In cases of common error or improbable and positive doubt of law or of fact, the church supplies jurisdiction for the internal and the external forum.
So there is something in canon law.
Canon 209.
Oh, okay.
Canon 209. And that's what really what all traditional Catholic clergy have to rely on, even the bishops. Bishop Piperunas, Bishop Dolan, Bishop Sanborn, Bishop Davila. They're relying on supplied jurisdiction to do what they're doing as bishops. Every priest I know will say, I'm relying on Canon 209 to give me the authorization to operate as I do, and I'm trying to follow the mind of the church as exactly as I can. And by the way, I would say, I've seen the home aloneers movement, if you want to call it that, go down because people realize it's a dead-end street. And I think they're realizing it's really heretical to say the church has disappeared, except, as Father Chicada would say about the home aloneers, they have no church to go to, so they have to worship in the bedroom of their choice. You know how you used to say on milk cartons, worship at the church of your choice?
Yeah.
All home aloneers have is what room am I going to say, what about my house am I going to say the rosary in?
Why are they refuting that? I mean,
it's been refuted. Actually, Father Chicada has refuted it very well. He's written excellent works. And like I said, I've seen the number of home aloneers go down. As a matter of fact, some people that were home aloneers came back to our parish. Yeah. They realized it was just nothing but a dead end and really heretical to say it's all disappeared. Yes?
Yeah, Father Chicada, on the traditional Mass de Virgis.
Yeah.
Monica has some friends from Alberta that were arguing with me on that. They sent me this huge book on the internet. It was reading through, it's just nonsense. And then I just sent them this article by Father Chicada and they just didn't say anything. It's so simple. It's two pages and it's already, everything is repeated. But I was going to say, Father, the supply jurisdiction, I wanted to make sure I understand it correctly. My understanding is that for every situation, for every confession you hear in every single Mass, that jurisdiction is supplied for each and every one individual. I always thought they possessed supply jurisdiction. You don't possess it because that would be ordinary jurisdiction.
No. It's, in other words, when Canon 209, it's so well written, and we could have a whole class on Canon 209. Just looking at it phrase by phrase, and just listen to it again phrase by phrase. In common error, what does that mean? It means if a group of people think a priest has authorization, by that very fact, the church authorizes him to hear their confessions for the good of their souls. Common error, or in cases, now notice all these adjectives, of probable, doubt, of fact, or actually not adjectives but nouns, probable doubt of fact or of law. In other words, if the doubt is about the fact or if the doubt is about the law, the church gives jurisdiction for the internal forum, confessions, and for the external forum. So it's a very, very wide divinely provided emergency blanket for so to speak. You know, I need authorization, I need supply jurisdiction in the internal forum for every confession that I hear. But in the external form, when I'm receiving a convert into the Catholic faith and I have to absolve him from excommunication, I need it in the external form. You know, I would think that even saying Mass, that's in the external form. I rely on the Church's authorization for that. But it's a very wide sort of thing. It shows the wisdom of and the divine guidance of the Church over 2,000 years that a security blanket would be provided for dire situations, and we are living in one. Yes.
Would that apply to the invalid Mass where the people don't know the difference? They think that they are receiving.
Yeah. No. See, the key thing there is, what about a priest who's saying an invalid Mass? Because Canon 209 cannot make up for the lack of a valid Mass. It will not make an invalid sacrament valid. We're talking about authorization to operate. Okay, that's already taken care of. Okay, so I think we've looked at how jurisdiction is obtained. Our last topic for today, how the Pope loses jurisdiction. I was thinking of getting into how bishops lose jurisdiction, how priests lose jurisdiction. I don't think we need to get into that because our focus is on this. But we could still discuss it for a minute or two. How do you think a bishop or priest or cleric would lose his jurisdiction? How could that happen? What kind of situation? Death. If once the bishop, the priest, the cleric dies, he loses his jurisdiction. What else? Yes. Well, if it has to be a serious disobedience where he gets excommunicated, or he incurs a censure from the bishop. Yes, a priest, or as a matter of fact, a bishop can go bad too. In the early 1900s, Pope St. Pius X excommunicated a Catholic bishop in England. I think his name was Matthew Harris. He excommunicated him because he became a rogue bishop. He just started doing things on his own and, you know, thumbed his nose at the Pope. So the Pope had to excommunicate him, and from that moment on, he lost all of his jurisdiction. Okay, so another way too is if a bishop or priest resigns his office. Okay, but his resignation has to be accepted by the higher authority. Also, what if the bishop or priest becomes a heretic and leaves the Catholic Church? Does he lose his jurisdiction then? Yes, he does. Anybody that becomes a manifest heretic leaves the Catholic Church.
But everybody else?
Pardon?
I'm sorry, everybody else, you know, all the Bible-thumping, tambourine-shaking Novus Ordo guys think he's just dandy.
I know, they think he's dandy, but do they have the Catholic faith? No, they've lost it. When you lose the Catholic faith, you lose your membership in the Catholic Church. Pope Pius XII made it very clear, and all the teachings of the Church have made it clear, the three things that automatically sever one from the Church are heresy, apostasy, or schism. Even before a declaration is made, they lose their membership at that moment. Okay, so these are how bishops and priests can lose their authority. But by the way, the priesthood can never be taken off the soul. So even if a bishop loses his authority, he doesn't lose his ordination. Same thing with a priest.
As long as it was a valid ordination,
which means that if he ends up in hell, he will suffer far more than others because he has the priesthood on his soul. I believe that Judas was a bishop. He was ordained a bishop at the Last Supper, and he's, you know, he his 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 punishment is greater than the average person because he had that many more graces given to him. Yes.
I was going to say, so Canon 209 typically would apply in those type of situations. For example, like someone in the past who had lost their office due to heresy, perhaps, but it wasn't formally announced. Maybe some people didn't know. Would that be? And then he was still acting.
Well,
didn't that happen many times? Like,
well,
we're not the, that wasn't heresy. Western schism.
Right, you know, those, you know, of their own nature. That's what Pope Pius XII said about heresy, apostasy, and schism. He says, of their own nature, it's like you're sitting on a branch and you cut yourself off from the tree. You did it. Okay? It wasn't a, you know, a dumb mistake or I didn't know any better. No, you knowingly, you knew what the church taught. You said, I don't accept it. What are you doing? Cutting yourself off and you fall down and you get badly hurt and die. Or die. Okay, so those three sins. Okay, so let's look, and we're running out of time here, so we've got about 5 minutes. How the Pope loses his jurisdiction, in other words, how does he lose the papacy? Two involuntary ways, two voluntary ways. Okay, so when he dies, he's no more the Pope. Also, if he falls into perpetual insanity, I mean, this can happen. You know, look at various diseases and ailments of the human condition. Somebody could fall into a perpetual coma, insanity. So if it's perpetual, he loses the papacy. He's not able to fulfill that office anymore. Okay, the voluntary ways are resignation and then heresy or apostasy, because he decided those. Okay. Death and perpetual insanity, the Pope did not decide those. Those just happened. Does that make sense? Okay. Now, here's the difficulty. We need a legal mechanism. We need a binding legal means of establishing the fact. So, what is the legal means of establishing the death of a Pope? How do we know it legally?
The doctor makes
his heart's not.
Actually, it says right here, the top cardinal called the Camerlengo certifies the death of a pope. Now, for all of us, the legal determination of death happens when? What does the doctor do?
Signs
the death certificate. Now, that's the state says basically they're going to accept any statement that a doctor makes in his official capacity. This person died of such and such. Now, if a person dies suddenly of unknown causes, what has to happen?
Autopsy.
It has to, you know, and the coroner gets involved. And I think the coroner will say this person is dead, but now we need to know why so that we can rule out any foul play. But when it comes to the Pope, of course the Camerlengo will consult with the doctors, but there's a special ceremony the Camerlengo goes through. He takes a little silver hammer and he approaches the Pope. There's all, you know, church officials surrounding him, and he goes up to the Pope and he calls him reverently by his baptismal name, not his Pope name, his baptismal name. He taps him lightly on the forehead with the silver hammer. He says, for example, Pope Pius XII, Eugenio. He does it a second time, Eugenio. Does it a third time, lightly tapping, Eugenio. I mean, it's all ceremonial. It's like royalty, you know, going through a very, very solemn procedure. And when there's no response from the Pope, and the Camerlengo knows there's not going to be one, he then says, the Pope is dead. and he signs the official certificate in the presence of all the church officials that have to be there. Then it's legally established that the Pope died. Now let me give you this. What if we have a scenario like this, where there's no, you're with the Pope on a desert island, just you and he dies. What do we do? Can we legally establish his death? Not unless you're the Camerlengo, right?
Well, it's common sense.
Exactly. Common sense tells us, you know, the body is starting to decay. Obviously, you would bury it with all possible reverence, because this was the vicar of Christ on earth. You don't just say, well, there's no Camerlengo, so he's still alive. So, but you see, we have to live by law, so there are these legal means. Yes, Susan.
I just wanted to ask you before we left, why was Judas made a bishop at the Last Supper? Jesus knew what was going to happen.
I know, but he knew that even before he picked him as an apostle.
Why would they go through all that?
Well, it's you as a parallel hypothesis, you could say, why did God make anybody that ends up in hell? He knew it. But you see, it's a mystery. It's a mystery. But if anybody ends up in the wrong place, it's not God's fault. It's just they chose to not cooperate with the grace of God, as did Judas. Okay, so very quickly, and I mean really, we've got to wrap this up in the next minute or two. Perpetual insanity, I couldn't find anything on this, but it would seem like the cardinals would have to gather and then have to make a vote. Now, they're not deposing him. They're just saying, we have decided as the cardinals that, and we, based on the soundest medical testimony, that, you know, he must not have, he's not capable of ever functioning again, so by the act of God, he's no longer the Pope. If a Pope resigns, all he has to do is say it, and it's done. Nobody has to agree with him. All the cardinals can say, Your Holiness, you can't do that. It doesn't matter. As long as he manifests it to the cardinals, I'm resigning, he ceases to be the Pope on the day that he chooses.
Has anybody resigned besides Benedict?
Oh yes, Pope Saint Celestine the Fifth. He was a hermit who was elected Pope, and he realized he just didn't have what it took to be the job. So he resigned. Okay, and then heresy or apostasy, and this is the problem: we don't have the legal means. But does that mean like remember we said about the Pope died? Are you going to just not bury him because there's nobody to legally? In other words, are you going to act even though there's no legal means to establish his death? Yeah. Common sense tells us, separate from heretics. Separate from those who are destroying your faith. So that's why, even though the popes of Vatican II are not legally declared non-popes, common sense tells us still to act as though they're not, because they don't have the faith. And we will have to stop there because the Holy Hour starts in about 2.5 minutes.